Hi, and welcome to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Stephen Cato, and here with me in our fantastic Chinatown studio is our other host, Nicholas Miller. Why don't you just say hi, Nick?
Hi, everyone. Hi there.
And yeah, welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if any of you have noticed, but I've gotten a new haircut.
And a spectacular haircut it is, Steve. Very nice. Not as nice as these new blue jeans I got, but pretty good.
That was for our live studio audience, I suppose. Some of you are listening to this, of course, on the internet. K-Chung maintains full and delightful archives of all of its shows. So don't forget, if you have missed any K-Chung programming, and I mean any K-Chung programming, if you're out of step with what, for example, Jack Hurd's up to or what have you, don't hesitate. Go to kchungradio.org and dig it out of the archive. It's right there. You can have it all at your fingertips. Do not hesitate.
Yeah. I mean, you can literally get this at any time.
What's that, Nick?
I was just telling the listeners, you can get the K-Chung archive at any time you want. Anytime. It's not like one of those infomercials where there's a countdown. Anytime. And if I could make one recommendation, a good friend of the talking show, Ian James, has a particularly great show up there on the archives right now.
Yeah.
So take a look at that or listen to it.
Anyway.
Whichever one you want.
Our guest today is one of the gray eminences of American letters. A really fantastic poet, John Ciardi. The man has won practically every award there is that can be thrown at you for this kind of thing. He has a rich voice. He's an experienced broadcaster. So expect none of the rude hiccups or weirdnesses of any of our past guests who, whatever their various gifts, perhaps speaking or being broadcast was maybe something new to them and they were still feeling the ropes out for themselves. This is something our next guest has a full and total mastery of. So sit down, get comfy, and enjoy one of the most decorated men in American letters, John Ciardi, on The Talking Show, K-Chung Radio.
This strangest everything, sunset and after, this easy gone world now, that one cloud it sets to like a whale in an aquarium of Chablis, shoaled on pink niblets, what is it like to be like nothing? It is like fact, I think. Days go and the sky invents itself. Sometimes a fete dances through it, sometimes a too muchness of bad watercolors, sometimes no riches, good or bad, but crags, stone waste, a fiat of that cobalt indifference all worlds are edged by. What is it like to see what is, these changes of impossible fact? This strangest everything was here and gone now, and I am the had-come-night's man, long to dark and simpler than God made me. Could he make, who is himself, I think, made by what is like nothing and leaves no mark? The longest way is back. The longest way is back. Lazarus learned, and every grown son at his equinox among the mating birds will, day returned is longer than day gone, The box of every funeral is glacier slow and grounds on fern. The stillest hours all snow. But even then, sleds burst by in a view of racing hills. A mother is so small, a taw could be her grave and headstone, too. A son's a box of lost taws. Is a doll a daughter's leavings? As the day returns, the lost doll spills its stuffing in the ferns. Birds make their nests of it. They come and go as if all hours were first. The grown sun sees the blur they were. A go, a go, a go, but has a plane to get to. His valise packs him to what he does. It takes his hand and pulls him to his taxi. Shall he stand against that tug? Birds are so light, so fast, how can they pull so hard against that weight who could not lift a taw? How do they last out of all boyhood? It grows late, in less time than it takes a man to pack and leave again. The longest way is back. Tucking myself to sleep at one more Hilton. I have a country, but no town. Home ran away from me. My trees ripped up their white roots and lay down. Bulldozers cut my lawn. All these are data toward some sentiment, like money. God knows where it went. There was a house as sure as time, sure as my father's name and grave, sure as trees for me to climb, sure as behave and misbehave, sure as lamb stew, sure as sin, as warts, as games, as a scraped shin. There was a house, a chicken run, a garden, guilt, a rocking chair. I had six dogs, and everyone was killed in traffic. I knew where their bones were once. Now I'm not sure. Roses use them for manure. There was a house, early and late. One day there came an overpass. It snatched the stew right off my plate. It snatched the plate. A whiff of gas blew up the house like a freak wind. I wonder if I really mind. My father died. My father's house fell out of any real estate. My dogs lie buried where time was when time still flowed, where now a slate-stiff river loops called Exit 9. Why should I bother? It isn't mine. I have the way I think I live. The doors of my expense account open like arms when I arrive. There is no cloud I cannot mount and sip good bourbon as I ride. My father's house is Hilton wide. What are old dog bones? Were my trees still standing, would I really care? What's the right name for this disease of wishing they might still be there if I went back? Though I will not and never meant to. Smash the pot, knock in the windows, blow the doors. I am not and mean not to be what I was once. I have two shores 5 hours apart, soon to be three, and home is anywhere between. Sure as the airport limousine, sure as credit, sure as a drink, as the best steak you ever had, as thinking, when there's time to think, it's good enough, at least not bad, better than dog bones and lamb stew. It does, or it will have to do. Damons. I pass enough savages on the street to credit the daemon in things. But they have forgotten how the soul breathes from plant, beast, and man, and must be propitiated. They do avoid 13ths, walk wide of ladders and black cats, make the sign of the cross for hearses. but shabbily, ritualists without conviction. My mother, at bone and breath, was the savage I learned from. When we poured concrete for a new house, she leaned over the half-filled forms, muttering, and dropped in a penny, a crucifix, a key, then pricked her finger and shook out a drop of blood, then stood there, waiting. Give in? Had she given enough? Because she meant to take no chances, I thumbed a bean pot open and gave her the beans, saying nothing, and she threw those in. That started her going again. Off she went to her kitchen and brought back oil, wine, a sliver of meat, snippets of all the food we had. In they went. Then she thought a minute and told me to spit. She was using everything she knew anything about, and she knew she was using it. That is my kind of savage. She was living at the ghost of all she lived by. Now suppose I say again, I do credit Damon's. Suppose I pick up a conch and blow it and ask if it hears itself making music. The idea loses you. But there go the savages in and out of Tiffany's, the Waldorf, the Cathedral, the Subway. They take place. They do not know themselves. They do, I suppose, move to the music they think they hear. But what I mean is, you have to hear yourself making the music you didn't know was in you, living at what you live by. At my father's grave, a leaf is not too little. A world may rest in no more shade than spiders weave. Defend the knit on every underside. I roost on less than it, and I must yet be found by the same bird that found St. Francis dead. It's cold as nothing in the eye I see, and anything's a rap. Had I the deed to all these stones, I'd burn it. Could I say what world this is, and saying let it be, I'd keep as still as wormholes in a thought and let it lack. A leaf could not blow by my silence and find room to land. If that is no real kindness for what sun I had when I was warm, most kindness is a waste. All kindness is too little. In my head there are more teeth than mercies. I'll go west and set the sun forever when I dare disturb the leaf that's wedged against my door. Coming home on the 5:22. A prosperous, well-tailored, plump, middle-aged man swings off the train before it stops. His 2-foot jump and small quick step spring a small pain in his hip socket, but his stride jaunts him away. This is a matter of pride. I really did that rather well. Not a track record, to be sure, but rather nimble all in all. The deft man lets his stride out, feels the power of blurring past the cracks in the concrete, his shadow strafes. Passionate, an athlete. How did this fat and foolish man come over me? He is not I, yet I am he, though I began as something else. When did I die? Well, tell the truth, not I, but they. All those I tried in prayer or play like trying on a self, not quite like thought, like hope, like fear. No, not like fear, that's something else. I'm not afraid of what I am. I can still hear all I've said. I can see all I've been forgiven. Sod rest ye, gentlemen. Let nothing ye dismay, and above sod, the world's for trying till the world be seen. I used to say this sort of thing to God. He didn't like an idiot for a son. I wasn't pleased myself, so I changed style. I was a little everything for a while. The one thing I was not until it came upon me without being asked was this middle of nothing much with no known name, this flab of putty playing spry, this piss out of a tree of apes, this vintage sour trying to act like God's first April shower. The rest I've been, that ape up in the tree, the botanist below it, the moon boy at every bodice, the missionary bee sucking for souls, the gunner with his toy, the stink of small ambitions, party clown, Professor Poop, pride of the noumenon. How many faces I have shed. I think I see bone. A sharp pencil could draw out that center till a man is dead, the fallen pencil pointless as dead wood when no hand holds it. Yet, in that hand's hold, the fact and instrument of a man told from himself to what a god might see had he a man's eye for the passioning and stroke and make of what it is to be too brief for his own fashioning, yet long enough to shed and shed and shed what he is not till he draw his own head. Draw it to bone, if bone is all that stays into his look, but draw it, bone of man, the intricate sad skull, its hollow grave, the blackened grin, the rounded white brain pan dove-jointed to the light, the eyes hoar caves where suns rose and the main deep spent its waves, held to the light on which the pencils slashed the drawing home and made a thing to see, this joker jaunting by, his belly cashed in tailored money, one hip and one knee creaking on calcium grit through which he plays Lard Agonistes, muscle man of days. Well, I forgive him. Every face melts off the ape there was and is in every bone. I know him well enough. I cough his cough and ache his aches. Closer than mother and son, I bear him and am born. Like you and you, nothing until a birth pain lets us through. Letter to a Midnight. You will tire of many acceptances, some of each day, like money not really worth making, will encumber prudence, taking time from you without changing it to anything. The cat, having been fed, will sleep at its own distance from sentiment. The clock will auction all houses past midnight, hammering home minute by minute what you can no longer bid for. When the floor creaks, that is not time, but the heat rising. Far off, if you listen, you will hear the furnace roaring what you paid for. The children are away, and their return will be only to visit. In her bed, their mother sleeps, a bride again, possibly yours, but not often. You did not return often enough, and cannot return. It is yesterday there, too long. Where is the flower from the lapel of a love ago? Duty is not enough husband and no father. A lost romp is forever. Can you tell them this kindly? No. Midnight's a dry correspondent and stuffy. Its letter full of inanities. A harumpher of dead and buried, I told you so's. I am damned to these conversations with an obstinate comfort. What a successful house not to live in. Pride, I tried the same. Come dancing, business is over. All customers dead or asleep. Children come tumbling, screaming, smashing the knick-knacks. Disturb me. Don't shush them, darling. These papers are better unread. Tomorrow's market will kiss nothing. To whom could I mail it? There is no delivery there. It returns addressee unknown. Use zip code for faster service. TJ, I try a draft of myself. I hope this memo will come as no surprise. That time of life, these many years, and still the cat I feed sleeping across the room, its distance from me. Not to be sure until the job's well filled. Meanwhile, to state my intentions, a first draft, a purpose to sleep on when I learn to sleep. Once I have read the books I meant to read, permitting interruption, begging impromptus, to come into a spending time unspent. You too will tire of doing what is not done but only balanced forever, because it tips forever, is less than a cat knows, keeping to itself, cannot be ended but only left. Another will come, but not to write this letter. That you must do for yourself. And the answer, too. Taking both sides of no correspondence to say what you know is nothing. I want a first again. As if I could know it before I saw it leave. Was a man. Ted Rettke was a tearing man, a slam-bang, wham-dam, tantrum-oh from Saginaw in Michigan, where the ladies sneeze at 10 below, but any man that's half a man can keep a sweat up till the freeze gets down to 99 degrees, for the hair on their chests, it hangs down to their knees in Saginaw. In Michigan. Ted Rettke was a drinking man, a brandy and a bubbly O. He wore a roll of fat that ran 6 times around his belly, O, then tucked back in where it began. And every ounce of every pound of that great lard was built around the very best hooch that could be found in Saginaw, in Michigan. Ted Rettke was an athlete, so it's pronounced in Michigan. He played to win and was hard to beat, and he'd scream like an orangutan and claw the air and stamp his feet at every shot he couldn't make and every point he couldn't take. And when he lost, he'd hold a wake, or damn you for a cheat. Sometimes he was a friend of mine, with the empties on the floor, oh, and God, it's fun to be feeling fine and a poor and poor and poor, oh. But just to show we were not swine, we kept a clock that was stopped at 10 and never started before then. And just to prove we were gentlemen, we quit when it got to 9. Ted Rettke was a roaring man, a ring-tailed, wing-ding, yippee-o. He could out-yell all Michigan and half the Mississippi-o. But once he sat still and began to listen for the lifting word, it hovered round him like a bird. And oh, sweet Christ, the things he heard in Saginaw. In Michigan. Now Rettke's dead. If there's a man awaking, lost, and wanting, oh, in Saginaw, in Michigan, he could hear all his haunting, oh, in the same wind where it began, the terrors it could not outface, but found the words of. And by grace of what words are, found time and place in Saginaw, in Michigan. Epithalamium at St. Michael's Cemetery. One note on the following poem may assist the listening. In the cellar of the Capuchin Church, just off the Via Veneto in Rome, there is a crypt in which deceased monks were left till they withered to skeletons. Their bones were then distributed around the walls and ceiling of the crypt as architectural ornaments. Some ancient monk must have been especially proud of managing to acquire the skeletons of two children, which he plastered into the ceiling as amoretti or angioletti, with bone wings attached within a floral border made of vertebrae and finger bones. Epithalamium at St. Michael's Cemetery. My father lay 50 years in St. Michael's bed, till we lay back the covers and bundled in the hag end of his lost bride, her wits shed some years before her light. Oh, bones begin with one gold-banded bone. The bride is dressed in tissue, 10 claws folded on no breast. Man and woman made he them, but gave dominion to dominion. Does he know how deep the whale goes to its grave, its hull of ribs still trembling in the flow under the dark he makes there, or that is unmade? If every deep is his, then all bounds are abysses, as they were when the set eyes of sphinxes still stared through their gilded doors to a green delta's stir of raid and hovering dynasts, while the Jew, back at his interrupted captivity in the ashes of lamentation, sang, "Ailey, Ailey, what loss is this when nothing's left to lose? She waited, and she came, and he is there whether or not he waited. Can we choose what we shall wait for? Can I find a tear for what this is? I have none left. I see a twice unfinished bridal. The shivery has been rescheduled. The Capuchin suite, a grotto off the Via Veneto, has been reserved for this first night, complete with its two skeletal cupids flying low, a crypt of the Dead Sea. There, side by side, the sodden groom, the driftwood bride, begin again forever what they began in God's will, or the sandblast through no door, or the wind in the Jew's ashes, or as this man and woman crossed their sea once, through whose floor Capuchin birds silt into the abyss he sets his bounds by, or that simply is. Incident. Not that it matters, or not much, and not to the children now, but it was spring as a daisy chain, and not yet hot, but skin prickle new, and the grass all lazy breeze lolly, when the madman came up from his wrong roots and played horrors with the children, who had been playing all sorts of nothing really, or all, and who died so hard even one of the cops cried. Who, for that matter, has cried enough for what feeds madness? This small boy and this small girl unwove their daisies and did not miss what they had been loving or just being glad in, which must be the same thing. It could have been rock winter and no garden. It did happen to be spring. But spring came to Dachau, too, and not one corpse there shows his season. This is a note on stagecraft. Soft days darken most. Imagination ceases contrasts. Horror dies of horror. This could have been done in a bitter time. Still the soft moon most calls the wolf. Bright sky the hawk. Madness wakens beyond intention, buzzes to soft airs, goes for a walk, and finds children playing. We are all dangerous till our fears grow thoughtful. No death is an invention. They were small, bright, hugely dark. And everything does matter, yes, but not to them now. The stones see light, winds keep diaries, a leaf, a child, tatter, a cause flows. There are madmen, but horror must first be made. The cop dried his eyes and swore war, his tears instantly wasted. Three dogs bayed. The madman was shot running over the same flowers the children had dropped. His. Ours. Boy. He is in his room, sulked shut. His small fist of a face clenched, his tears as close to holy water as I recall any first font shining. A boy, and fierce in his sacrament, father forced this two-faced way love has. And I, who am chain-chafed and galled as any son, his jailer, my will, his cell, his hot eyes, mine. Whose will be done, I think, wrong as a man? Oh, very well, I make too much of nothing, much my will a while. A boy's tears dry into the smudge of any jam. Time hurts, but I am not much destiny. I am at best what cries with him, at worst a smallest god, the keeper of one lamb that must be made to follow. Where? That takes more god than I am to make clear. I'm wrong as a man is, but right as love, and father of the man whose tears I bless in this bud boy. May he have cried enough when he has cried this little. I confess I don't know my own reasons or own way. May sons forgive the fathers they obey. One day in a rush of dogwood, all the world married. There were the flower girls balancing all their airs like leaf buds on new wood. There was the catered lawn served in such light as only jonquil's candle, and the mother of all in the cloud head of her boughs. Oh, even the father stones were garlanded light, while the groom at his gap in the head stood dark and new, rain gloss in the swirls of his bark, and an aspen air trembling inside him, and nodding and nodding and nodding, the iris and tulip and hyacinth borders touched heads in the spray of a last light bursting, tiniest, almost not rain. And then, so fast it happened, there was not time for reason to change anything dark. The sun, like all the brass in the orchestra, spoke one note long to the spray that instantly rainbowed, and there, down the aisle of its hour, the garden of all was coming. An edge, a twilight, a plover. I had left myself on the beach like a towel, while no mind's glaze floated to wherever zenith is from here. When I got back, my soul was blue curds, and I half covered with the sand everyone else had gone from. I rolled over and saw seaward a sky striped blue and white like a tent, but more a dome with no center than a place kingpinned and capped. Not something, but part of it. I was still nowhere, but less amply. There was a sea in it, and light going, though slowly yet. Then a plover lit there, almost at eye level, gathered its instinct right for a last jab at the sand, and brought up a worm that hung like an omega from its beak. An instant, then gone. This nowhere from my eye was edible. I too could seek and find, perhaps. Perhaps not as far as any bird comes from. Perhaps near. Or here. Why don't you write for me? For you or of you? It can't be both. If you must ask that question, you are not ready for yourself. If I write for you, I must write about someone else, someone dead, though you haven't heard of that death. If of you, you haven't heard that news either, then what can I tell you? You see, there are few customers in this business. Not that it matters. I live by eating up the profits. There is that to be said for it as a business. Check the books any way you like. There is always a profit, and it can always be eaten. Scorn you? Never. Customers are always welcome, cherished even. I mean, I have learned to stock only what I can live by when no customers come. When one does come, therefore, it follows that he can buy only what I have my own appetite for. A black bread store, if you like. Stiff crusts and garlicky cores. But learn to like it, and nothing can feed you better. A Ballad of Teleologies. Says Ego's ape, shaking its tree, I'd know exactly how to be, had I the courage for it, free. Says Ethelred the adolescent, strike for the shore, it's manly pleasant to terrify the southern peasant. Says Bonifacio of the Lord, Logos, the all-creating word that proves itself, is my reward. Says Teleos, the microscope, look in, this dark through which we grope is lit by particles of hope. Says Father Malthus, I'm delayed but not denied, the table's laid for the last tuber, I'm afraid. Says Father Marx, who gave the law, I must confess I'm left in awe, it comes to more than I foresaw. What shall I say, except roll on, I've bought my house, begotten a son, most of what time I had is gone. The only tray I've left to shake is my own nervous system. Quake, I whisper to it, but then I wake. There are some peasants I might raid to prove I'm afraid of being afraid. What then? A billion in foreign aid? I guess I haven't found the Lord, whoever lost him. I grew bored with praying for future bed and board, especially when, if I'm half right, I'll probably sleep out all night and can't foresee much appetite. That leaves me Telios, Malthus, Marx, there with me like three Noah's arks of goblins riding on the darks of everybody's drowning void. And oh, good Lord, I left out Freud. A slip. Still, what's that anthropoid I started with? If an analysis doesn't reveal he's what a phallus is, and what he's shaking's really Alice's hoped for participation in the tree, the tribe, original sin, or just the particles that spin genetic crises called the state, which must at last emasculate what apes it doesn't emulate, and so rewrite whatever plot we shall be part of, if we're not deleted from that afterthought. Two lectures and a few flourishes. One, on Pico della Mirandola. Pico della Mirandola, when he was 19, spoke 22 languages. He was then at the court of Lorenzo de' Medici, the gilded Florentine, in honor of whom he offered to retort to any 700 questions proposed by the sages of all nations, and to do so in the language of the asker. It must be supposed they could not make it to Florence just then, for Pico remained untested, as all accounts agree. The date he set was 1483. 3 years later, to honor his lord and friend, he compiled from Arabic, Hebrew, and classic sages 900 theses he would rise to defend in instant disputation. Alas, the wages of intellect and vaudeville equally are spent in travel. The High Inquisition, twitching its low nose, sniffed out heresy. Pico abandoned Florence and disquisition and traveled to other parts for his health's sake. He had too much at stake and at the stake to stay and argue, though, as you may have guessed, he felt some slight, not to himself alone, but to all intellect, was in fact depressed by what the honest mind must yet atone of the world's fault, and yet shall merit be triumphant for a price. Whoever paid it, he was absolved in 1493 by the Pope himself, who had been, before he made it, Rodrigo Lenzuola Borgia, and who had brought nothing to office that could not be bought as he had bought it. Can the man of mind find propositions here to call him forth to towering exhortation? Or do we find, with Savonarola perhaps, that a man's worth is lessened at the stake? Toward a half hope, I defend Pico, who, though he talked too high, revised low. Buy from the world. When a Borgia's pope, buy from the Borgias, but be prepared to buy or burn, unless, of course, you are enlightened by being lit, cheered when you char, in which case you may share the glory art is, and some of my admiration and all of Sparta's, but first see Possum, Fox's Book of Martyrs. 2. Three Borgias. Now, having thus discoursed on things pertaining to Pico and to Alessandro Sesto, to intellect, and to the still remaining uncertainties every honesty must confess to between conceived idea And the real seizure a world becomes when license from the bed that bore then shook to Caesar and Lucrezia. Having thus discoursed, though with much unsaid, let me add to those instances that mind must weigh like diamonds, these addenda. 1. Caesar and Alessandro, both inclined to politic poisoning, drank off their own potion by such an error as lets reason hope for its renewal and lets morals grow. Poisoner, watch the cup. Exit one pope, and enter then addendum 2. Although Caesar drank the same wine, his strength was such, combined with antidotes he understood, he did not die, although he suffered much. His cure was centered in 4 posts of wood set firmly in his chamber floor. Each day a live bull was led in, thrown on its back, one leg lashed to each post. The red beast lay, a 2-foot slit cut in its belly's slack and its intestines drawn. Into the skin of the still pulsing beast, Caesar was sealed up to his neck. There, in delirium, in the bloodbath of the beast was healed. Which leaves, as footnote to some history, an image of the species in its tub, confounding all such morals as will be drawn from more blood than mind may hope to scrub, though mind must work at it, or not be mind. Caesar died, fighting for nothing, not much later. So, to addendum 3. 2 dead, we find Lucrezia baffling every explicator of moral balances by living on a duchess, honored, and with no regrets, at least none showing. And so ends no sermon, but only fact, compiled in 3 vignettes, footnoted on 3 tombs, and filed away where every bone is mankind demonstrated, and so some piece of truth, if we could say which truth of what each bone once illustrated.
Well, what do you think of that, Nicholas?
Well, the ocean sounds were really quite nice and pleasant.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed listening to the ocean. Uh-huh. I can say that much.
No, I see what you mean. I really do. I see what you mean. It's sort of an open challenge, isn't it?
A challenge?
More of a dare.
I don't... Oh, you mean the Chianti guy.
Ouch.
Or whatever his name was. I don't know. I thought it was kind of dry, to be honest. But you seem to like it. What do you think?
I think what I like so much about John Ciardi is, funnily enough, something I actually like about David Hume, who I've heard actually is supposed to be pronounced like something like home or whom, maybe with more of a Scottish whom. Hume, I don't know. Anyway, the English philosopher, of course, is who I'm speaking about. And it's not a particularly powerful or meaningful section of Hume's. I'm just going to stick with it because, you know, it's the modern world. It's the 21st century. However they pronounced it back then, I'm just going to go for it. It's America. It's not Scotland. It's now. It's not then. David Hume. I'm going for it. It's not the David Hume that is most often quoted, and it's not a particularly meaningful part of his work. But what it reminds me of is this section in Hume where he talks about what is good And of course, Hume has a very, very material perspective on what is good. So, an empirical perspective on what is good. So, good food, for example, is good. Moderate warmth is good. And actually, the phrase that specifically our guest today called to mind was the pleasure of moderate warmth. I think one thing that's so incredible to me as well, other than the even-keeled moderate pleasure that is largely Ciardi's subject and kind of also, I would feel, sort of his desired effect with this work, this Humean, empirically good feeling. Other than that, the other thing that's so interesting to me about this is that this work genuinely comes from a period and an idea that there was such a thing as art for everyone or for a large portion of the general public. Ciardi had a show on NBC. He was a public figure in certain respects. And this seems pretty outrageous to me now. I can't think of many other poets who have television shows. I can't think of a time when the idea of making something comprehensible didn't come with the idea of making something stupid. It seems almost impossible to imagine this kind of normal art being produced anymore. I can't imagine anyone, myself included, really wanting to see anyone now making any normal art, writing any normal poetry. This isn't mind-bending. It's very, very normal. And it can't take you, I don't think, to dizzying heights. You can pretty much only get moderately warm from this kind of work. But it certainly beats being cold. So where does that leave us exactly? I think part of the appeal for me with this kind of thing is this nostalgia for this period of public intellectualism, marquee philanthropy, this kind of stuff in America, and the kind of thing where an idea of a public good did not seem so totally preposterous, such that this kind of moderate, normal work wouldn't exist, so that avant-gardes had something pretty regular to battle with in their own rights. I mean, on another level, what's nice about this very down-home, families and pets kind of poetry is it does make you want to go be a pervert or something. I mean, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Nicholas?
You mean, how about an empirical good? I don't know. I've always felt very uneasy about saying something like, well, that's a really good martini. And I guess it's because that utterance resembles a moral judgment. And I don't really know what kind of semantic drift has tossed that word good around so much that it has become so difficult to use in any rigorous way. I think that's why I feel so uncomfortable with it. And as for this down-home artist that you've been describing, it seems to me to resemble something like a servant or a laborer or a worker in society, someone whose role and tasks are predefined or presupposed for them. And if that's the case, then this type of being in the world that this artist experiences is something that I want nothing to do with.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, Good night, everybody. Have a fantastic evening. Get lots of sleep.
Stay moderately warm.
And we'll see you next week.